This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Unbury Carol by Josh Malerman. Read for you by Dan John Miller. For Derek, Ryan, Rachel, and Kevin. The Trail. Summer. Ukatanani and Miskaloosa Counties. At the funeral of John Bowie. Harrow's, situated at the northernmost point of the trail, savored its distance from the meat of the rabid road. It was easily the most affluent town in both counties. The homes of Harrow's were larger, often constructed of stately stone, some with as many as 10 bedrooms. The garden yards were as wide as the fabled trail itself, some roofs as high as the willows. Even better. Harrow's enjoyed more sunlight than the other towns, as the shadows cast by the arching of those willows concluded where the wheat fields began, just south of the border. Sunny and secluded, remote and rich, Harrow's was a very desirable place to live. But that didn't preclude its citizens dying. John Bowie found this out the bad way.
"One of a kind,"
Carol Evers said, standing beside her husband Dwight, looking into the open grave of her friend John Bowie. The tears in her eyes reflected the unboxed man below. One of Harrow's most likable men, Bowie was a very funny thinking man who added to every affair he attended. His lively eyes often smiled behind his thick glasses, and his ceaseless appetite was welcomed by all who had spent an afternoon cooking for a party. John Bowie was a good man. John Bowie was a fun man. John Bowie was also a homosexual who posed no threat to Dwight Evers, Bowie being the closest friend Carol had. For this, Bowie was the only person outside her husband whom Carol had told of her lifelong condition. It wasn't an easy thing for her to reveal. And yet it had come out of her so easily one clear evening on the back porch of her and Dwight's home. John had been discussing books and magic tricks, two of his most profound interests, when Carol suddenly rose from the bench and told him.
"I've died before, John. Many times."
Though famous for a healthy sense of humor, John wasn't one to take such a statement lightly, and Carol's green eyes often betrayed when she was serious. "Tell me," he'd said, his boots resting upon a wooden stool, his body hunched in a wicker chair. It was Carol's favorite posture, he assumed. Perhaps that was what loosened her lips.
"Tell me about every single time."
And Carol did tell John Bowie about every time she had died, every time she could remember. The doctors, she said, had no name for her condition, but she'd come up with one of her own many years ago.
"Howltown," she'd said. "That's what I started calling it around age 8. I guess I was influenced by the names of the trail towns, the only places I knew of, and it is something of a town, to me. No sheriff, of course, no boardwalk, no bank, no booze, no nothing. But it's a place, here on the trail, all the same, even if I'm the only one who visits."
She had paused. John noticed an odd combination of expressions on her face. Carol was both recalling her youth, when she named her coma, and despairing that it still existed.
"To someone outside the coma," she continued, "I appear dead, hardly a heartbeat, far from fogging a mirror, and a pulse as slow as a slug. There's no light in there, John. I can hear the world around me, but I can't move. And the wind in there, it howls. So, Howltown. Pretty neat, huh?"
She told John how afraid she once was of the isolation of the coma, how her mother Hattie's constant tinkering in the workroom acted as an anchor to reality.
"Without Hattie, I'd have broken in there, gone mad."
She told him of the hoarse breathing that acted as music in Howltown, and how Hattie said it must be Carol's own. She told John about the falling sensation, too.
"From the second it starts, I'm falling. I fall into the coma, and I don't touch ground until I wake."
John could see the relief in the face of his brilliant friend as she spoke. Carol, John knew, hadn't told anybody but Dwight. She was embarrassed over it, he surmised, convinced that her condition would be considered a burden and send most running.
Carol had intimated that someone had run from her before. John listened closely and had ideas of his own. And as he spoke, Carol realized why she had suddenly decided to confide in someone other than her husband. It wasn't only for safety's sake, though that played a major part, for what if Dwight were to die while Carol was inside the coma? Who would know that she still lived? But telling John Bowie had just as much to do with Carol's desire to hear what he thought of it. John had many things to say. John was as bright as Howltown was dark. And now John Bowie was dead. Lying barefoot in a gray suit on the bumpy dirt 6 feet beneath Carol's yellow shoes, John had been taken by the illness, knew his death was afoot, and had asked for no box. Carol herself had seen to it that her naturalist friend, Harrow's resident pantheist, would decay the way he wanted to. Directly into the dirt.
"He looks a bit like he fell right into the hole," Dwight whispered to Carol, the couple shoulder to shoulder.
Carol's yellow dress flapped in a breeze that didn't seem to reach her husband's black suit.
"It's what he wanted," Carol whispered,
and her voice sounded much older than the 38 years she was. The funeral director, Robert Manders, stood at a podium at the head of Bowie's grave, telling the grievers what they already knew.
"A brilliant mind, an enthusiast, a thirst for knowledge in all subjects."
Carol thought of John performing simple magic tricks at parties, making olives vanish, pulling plums from the ears of drunk women. She tried to smile, but couldn't bring herself to do it.
"In the end," Dwight whispered, "no magic trick can save you."
"What?"
"It's sad," Dwight said. "That's all."
"You two have as much in common as I do with a ladies' man," John once told Carol. "You know he married you for your money, right?" But Carol hadn't liked that joke and told him as much. Dwight nodded across the grave to his colleague, Lafayette. Carol caught the gesture. Of all the people Dwight associated with, the woman Lafayette was perhaps the least likable. Her gut hung proudly over her black belt and tested the silver buttons of her white wool shirt. A cemetery wind toyed with her long ponytail, sending it flapping across the deep wrinkles in her face. She'd always looked something like a witch to Carol, and Carol couldn't imagine a single sentence that might have been exchanged between the pompous, dubious prig and the amazing man John Bowie, who lay barefoot in his gray suit on his back below. Perhaps self-conscious of the unboxed man, conservative Manders concluded his eulogy more quickly than Carol expected. Then again, Bowie's entire life had concluded more quickly than Carol expected. The illness, she knew, was something to be scared of. Yet for a woman who had died many times, Carol was perhaps less afraid than most.
"Hell's heaven," Dwight said. "I can hardly stomach this."
Carol brought her lips close to her husband's ear.
"Dwight, shut up."
It was no secret Dwight had as little in common with John as did the witch Lafayette. Normally this bothered Carol deeply. How was it she'd married a man who didn't see the shine in her brilliant favorite friend? How was it John couldn't make Dwight laugh? How was it... But today was no day to be upset with Dwight. And yet the couple were on hard times indeed.
"It's because he doesn't ask questions like I do," John once said.
Carol could almost hear his voice now.
"He's more bull than man, and that's coming from a friend with a lot of turkey in him."
John was always making jokes, but more important, always making Carol laugh. She looked to his lips just as the gravediggers Lucas and Hank shoveled dirt upon his chest and chin. Then, with her mind's ear, Carol heard him say something he had never actually said while living, something he would probably say now if he could.
"Who else are you going to tell now? Someone needs to know. What if you slipped into the coma right now, and Dwight somehow died while you were in there? You need a safety valve, Carol. Security. I'm gone now. Do my ghost and the ghost of your mother a favor. Tell someone else."
"We need to tell someone else,"
Carol suddenly whispered. Dwight turned to face her.
"Tell someone else what?"
As Manders closed his book of notes, as Lucas and Hank covered Bowie's head completely,
Carol closed her eyes and repeated herself.
We need to tell someone else.
Come on, dear, Dwight said, tugging her elbow as the other grievers started to move from the graveside. Let's discuss this at home. But did Dwight know what she meant? She couldn't be sure. And why not? Her mother, Hattie, would have known. Hattie would already be sawing the pieces for her plan B. John would have known, too. Dwight nodded a good day to Lafayette and led Carol to the cemetery grass.
What is it?
He asked. Carol began walking toward their coach.
What is it?
He repeated.
What is it? A good friend has died. That's what it is.
My heart is as heavy as yours, Dwight said, catching up. Though Carol hated to hear it, John was often right about Dwight. And recently, Dwight had changed. 10, 5, even 3 years ago, he would be holding her hand, an arm draped over her shoulders, discussing the very topic she wanted him to address. John Bowie was dead. Someone else needed to know about Howelltown. And yet talking about her condition was one of the hardest things for Carol Evers to do. She had been spurned before. Inside the coach, she spoke her mind, and the argument began.
Now nobody knows, she said,
juggling the sorrow of losing John and the fear of being vulnerable once more.
Knows what, dear?
Dwight looked as lost as a wolf cub with no pack.
I'm talking about my condition.
Dwight nodded, but Carol couldn't tell what the nod meant.
And now nobody knows, he said. Someone other than you needs to. If not, there's a very real risk of my being mishandled.
Dwight laughed. Carol, stunned, sat up straighter.
Why are you laughing?
What are the chances, Carol? What are the chances that you'd slip into a coma right now and that I would then drop dead while you were inside? The way he said it, Carol felt a little embarrassed for being so angry. And yet...
If there's one thing Hattie taught me, it was not to waste a second when it comes to this. We need to tell someone. A doctor can't even detect a pulse when I'm in there. And hell's heaven, Dwight, you should have brought this up yourself.
I'm sorry, Carol. Who do you want to tell? Carol heard the distant echo of hoarse breathing, or perhaps it was the actual horses taking them home.
Farah.
The maid girl?
Yes.
I don't think I agree. You tell her and everybody's going to know.
So what?
Well, it's you who keeps it secret. I'm just thinking of you, dear. But he wasn't, Carol could tell.
Farah is perfect, Carol said. She's bright, she's kind, and she's close.
Her husband, Clyde, is a drunk, loose lips.
Well, then, that's how it will be, and everybody will know.
Are you sure?
Yes.
She thought of John Bowie, whereas Hattie thought it wise to keep it a secret.
They'll take advantage of you, Carol. Men from the trail.
John encouraged her to let everyone in.
In the end, people are kinder than you think, Carol, even the ones you thought were not. Yes, I'm absolutely sure.
But Dwight could tell she wasn't. Carol had suggested others before. As the coach rolled rocky over stones in the road, Dwight adopted a more serious posture. He placed a hand upon hers.
Do you feel it coming on?
Some of the steam of the argument was released. Dwight sounded concerned after all.
I don't know.
They rode in silence with this between them, the knowledge that Dwight believed her comas were caused by stress, her many adamant refutations that they were not. She'd gone under when Hattie died, yes, but she'd also gone many times when, it appeared, life was fine. Home, inside, the discussion picked up again.
Do you plan on telling her yourself tonight on your walk through the garden?
Dwight removed his suit coat and hung it in the foyer closet. Carol crossed her arms. Her eyes, damp with half-shed tears, reflected the lit candle on the credenza.
How about this? She said. If I haven't told Farah by the next time I go under, I'd very much like you to tell her.
She nodded, as if Dwight telling Farrah was easier than Carol doing it herself. Because, after all, it was.
You can bring her into the bedroom and show me to her in person. Have her feel my pulse. Show her how dead I am, and yet still living.
Dwight nodded. This was more like Carol, unsure after all.
I promise, he said. He wondered if Carol heard humoring in his voice.
The next time it happens, let Farrah in.
I promise.
Then, for Carol, the front door beyond her husband rippled, a slight rising wave from bottom to top. She heard the hoarse breathing of Howltown. Ripples didn't always mean the coma was coming, but no coma had ever come without them.
Maybe you should take it easy tonight, Dwight said. No walk.
Carol saw real concern on his face. She stepped to him and kissed his forehead.
Don't plan so much, Dwight.
She placed a fingertip between his eyes.
It's as if you've got an entire scene in there, the way things are supposed to play out, and you don't want anything to change that.
Dwight half smiled. Just worry, dear. Carol left the foyer and found Farrah in the parlor.
I'm sorry,
Farrah said.
About your friend.
By the way Farrah was doing nothing in the parlor, not a strand of her brown hair out of place, Carol understood that she'd been listening to the discussion. How much had she heard?
Let's walk, Carol said, and her voice betrayed her sorrow. The air will do us some good.
Outside, the sky was graying, but enough blue endured to show the pair the path that wound through the perennials, the fruit-sprouting shrubs, the primary colors of the Evers estate. This, Carol knew well, was the sweet time. For as wonderful as the flowers looked under the sun, there was no debating the beauty of the grounds by storm. And a storm, Carol saw, was coming.
Carol?
Farrah said, and Carol knew what the girl was going to say.
I confess I overheard some of your conversation with Mr. Evers.
Pebbles crunched under Farrah's plain shoes and Carol's boots.
Yeah? And what did you hear?
Carol wanted Farrah to have heard it all. Then, just as suddenly, she didn't.
Only a handful of words.
Farrah stopped walking and breathed deep.
I heard you telling him that it was time you told me something.
Carol stared long into the girl's face. Her wide brown eyes spoke less of wonder and more of youth.
Yes, Carol said, but maybe, not just yet, let's walk.
Carol then sensed the ripple coming strong and looked up, expecting to see it inches from her eyes.
Carol? I feel a little strange,
she said as the pair reached the bottom of a limestone stairwell.
Carol, we ought to bring you back inside if that's how you feel.
Carol raised a flat palm.
Not in peril, Farrah. Just odd, sad for my friend, John.
Farrah looked to her lady's face, and Carol felt her looking. The girl was as sweet as a Range Rider brownie, Carol liked to say, and as much a friend as any in her life. Maybe, Carol weighed, it was time, the perfect time to tell her. Not just yet, she thought, looking out over the flowers and plants, searching for evidence of that ripple. She wanted to tell Farrah, but it was not easy. She had been spurned once before. A change of subject was in order.
How is Clyde?
Carol asked, the sadness in her voice apparent. At not quite 20 years old, the girl had a love life that seemed so much more tangible than Carol's own. In a peaceful yet longing way, Carol guessed the majority of her own explosive life moments had already happened. Arguments that lasted deep into the morning hours, love that shouldn't have been, great emotions, terrible emotions, words plucked from snowy peaks, conversations without end, and decisions that were made without the knowledge of their influence. But Farrah spoke of her problems with the endearing air of one who believed her trouble to be the trouble of the world, her decisions planetary, her disappointments red with imaginary bloodshed. Carol enjoyed very much hearing that the world was still on fire, every wave in the water a killer, every moon the shape of hysterics. John liked the very same things.
Clyde is Clyde.
Carol gasped as a ripple seemed to pass over the dirt at their feet. For a moment, it looked as if her boot tips were underwater.
Maybe we should head back,
Farrah said, concerned. But a second ripple came, bigger than the first. Carol stumbled and reached for Farrah's shoulder.
Okay,
Farrah said, the bits she had heard of the conversation echoing in her head.
Time to take you inside.
She took Carol's hand and led her out of the garden.
You know,
Carol said, trying to ease the moment, seeing her young friend's worried profile as they walked back toward the house.
I had moments like you had with Clyde when I was your age. Really?
Farrah asked, happy Carol was talking, though her lady was breathing hard.
Tell me, have you heard of James Moxie, the outlaw? Maybe, but yes,
Carol said.
That's him.
Farrah stopped and turned to face her, her eyes and mouth perfect circles in her flushed face. Despite the funereal day, the news was flammable.
You kissed an outlaw, Carol? Well, he wasn't an outlaw back when I knew him. His glory came years after. Hattie met him. What? He came over one night. What? James Moxie was at your house, met your mom.
Carol pivoted, turning her face from Farrah. By talking about James Moxie, she had inadvertently reminded herself of something that felt very meaningful to her then. There was someone else who knew about her condition. Someone other than Dwight. Someone who had run from her 20 years ago, unable to shoulder the burden of caring for a woman who died so often.
There is someone else who knows.
She said the words aloud to herself, but of course Farrah heard them.
Who knows what, Carol?
Carol shook her head, shooing the revelation away, perhaps storing it.
Well, it was something, I suppose, our brief run. I believe he's down in Mackatoon now. I can't be sure. Do you mean it was more than a kiss? That's not what I meant, Digger, but yes, it was something. How much of something?
Carol shook her head, shooing Farrah away. They were on the lawn now, nearing the house.
One day, Carol, one day when you're not feeling so odd, you are going to tell me the whole story, and I'm going to listen. Oh, am I going to listen to that one?
Carol smiled, and the heartbreak she felt for having lost John Bowie showed all the way through.
Oh, Carol, I'm sorry.
Carol pulled open the creaky wooden back door, and the two stepped inside. Before shutting it, Carol looked to the garden, to the stone steps and the many paths beyond.
Farrah,
she said,
I would very much like to tell you something.
Farrah turned and saw her lady in the doorframe, still looking away from her.
What is it?
Without turning to face her, Carol said,
I have a condition, Farrah, a sickness, you might say. It doesn't knock often, but when it does, I've no power not to let it in.
As she spoke the words, she saw it. The rise and fall of the horizon, the woods beyond the gardens themselves. She took hold of the wooden doorframe and braced herself for the wave. The pond appeared to rise with it.
Carol?
The plants in the garden trembled, the bees dropped to the grass. Even the garden statues and the stone steps were made to move, stomping violence into the earth.
Carol!
It arrived at her boots, distorted the leather, rattled the hem of her dress.
Hell's heaven, Farrah. It's here.
Then Carol collapsed, and Farrah's scream followed Carol into Howltown. Howltown. Falling. 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 And the winds came at her, and the darkness was absolute. Carol retained a vivid image of the back door's threshold coming at her as she collapsed, felt the forever sensation of falling. She knew it well. When she was a little girl, the free fall was the scariest part. Now she'd try to heed her mother's 3-decade-old advice.
Think of it as flying. More fun than falling.
and John Bowie's more abstract slant.
If you accept the falling as normal, it can become its own solid ground.
But John was drunk when he said it, and John had never been to Howltown. Unless, Carol thought, Howltown is like being dead, and being dead is like Howltown. The feeling, the falling, would last until she woke, it always did, until her feet found solid ground in the form of opening her eyes as her heart resumed its natural beat, as her lips parted, and she could speak once again. But it was always a very long time till then.
Dwight's the only one who knows.
Thoughts were indistinguishable from speech in the coma. Thoughts were as loud as the voices of others. And this particular thought wasn't entirely true. James Moxie knew. It was why he'd run from her so long ago. And yet what good was it, Moxie knowing? How would he, a person glued firmly to her past, ever learn of her being in trouble, if into trouble she ever fell?
"Stop worrying, please. You'll land in a few days, like always."
She heard the familiar labored breathing, the hoarse wheeze Hattie told her must be her own. Carol had heard it faintly all day, but it was more definitive now, just as the color black itself was more complete than her memory of it, as if a child had colored a whole piece of paper, colored it all black. Carol thought of Farrah's expression just as the last ripple hit, the anticipation of a secret about to be shared. Over the duration of Farrah's employ, Carol had gone under twice, and with each turn, Dwight had asked for privacy, as his lady had taken ill. But as good a man as any of the staff thought him to be, they also knew he was no doctor. Farrah and the other employees of the house had their questions as to what was wrong with Carol Evers. And the rumor mills never pumped so furiously as they did in the kitchens and gardens of finer homes. The hoarse breathing continued steadily, and Carol thought of John Bowie, as if, in death, he had access to the coma, as if she could hear his lifeless lungs continuing to pump air to his lifeless body.
John!
John used to brainstorm solid surfaces Carol might be able to hang on to in the coma.
"Reach out if you can, as you fall. If you sense anything against your fingertips, anything at all, grab it."
Over drinks in the parlor, it was an exciting idea. And yet once inside, once falling, Carol couldn't move at all. The only motion she felt came from the falling itself. The cold wind against her. Still, Carol tried. The image of the threshold still vivid in her memory and mind's eye. The sound of breathing continued, the slow, steady rumble that reminded Carol of her grandfather's wheezing. And just beyond it, between inhales and exhales, Carol heard familiar voices, the vague, distant syllables of Dwight and Farrah talking. Carol always heard the external world while inside the coma. But it was an unstable version of that world, as if the individual tones and timbres of the voices were amplified. The emotions behind them, too. Dwight must be explaining her secret to Farrah, Carol thought, calming the girl down. Yet as the words sharpened, at times clearer, at others distorted, Carol heard Dwight speaking like the grievers at Bowie's funeral. His words came flat and final. There was resignation in his voice, as if Carol had in fact died this time. Falling. 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 Carol tried to listen harder, but the wind of falling wouldn't let her. Hattie used to simulate this very thing by flapping papers close to Carol's ears as Carol sat in a chair in the workroom. Hattie would ask her to listen past the papers, to the other rooms of the house. At first it was difficult for an 8-year-old Carol to grasp. But one afternoon, through the crinkling, she heard the voice of a neighbor calling for the family dog, and Carol understood how it was done. 3 decades later, Carol understood there were moments, while falling, that concentration could not penetrate. But there were also moments that it could. John Bowie was long fascinated by the fact that Carol could hear while inside the coma. Once she had shared her secret, he'd sit beside her and read, talk, joke, as Carol fell blind through the coma. Dwight didn't like it. He said he was partial to her remaining calm and unbothered when she slipped into her death-like trances.
But Carol enjoyed it deeply when John's comforting, sing-songy voice danced throughout her personal darkness, as he did magic tricks for her that she could not see. She longed for his voice now, the words of that wonderful man. But it was Dwight whom she heard instead.
"We must carry her upstairs."
Carol imagined him kneeling beside her inert body, which must have been half in, half out of the house.
"Should I call a doctor?"
Farah asked, her voice bright, edged with hysteria.
No,
Dwight said, and Carol believed the explanation was coming, the revelation of her condition. But what Dwight said instead, what Carol thought she heard, turned the winds in the coma to ice.
"She's dead, Farah."
The words were so wrong to Carol, so untrue, that she imagined she'd heard them wrong. After all, how often had she truly heard the world beyond those crinkling papers?
"Dead?"
Farah asked, the single syllable erupting like thunder in Howltown.
"Is there a difference?"
John once mused, folded upon that wicker chair on the porch.
"Between Howltown and death, and if so, how would you know what it was?"
Falling, Carol tried to remain calm. She must have heard Dwight wrong. Must have. Must.
"Maybe it's the space we all long for," John said. "Everyone wants to get away. You actually get the chance to do it."
Dwight spoke.
"It's a terrible thing, but Carol has..."
"She was just about to tell me something,"
Farah said, her voice shaking. Because both were breathing heavier, and in the coma their breathing sounded like gusts of dark wind, Carol believed that they were carrying her now. They were most likely halfway up the stairs, rising, and yet Carol continued to fall deeper down.
"What did she tell you?"
Dwight's words were sharp, harsh, as if he was trying to read the maid's mind.
"Have you read much about telekinesis?"
John once asked her. And his voice traveled through the gradations of darkness inside. An old question echoed.
"Because the rules don't seem to apply in your coma. For starters, you appear dead when you're not. Perhaps inside you can do things you can't do out here. Like, for example, move objects with your mind."
Desperately, still denying the truth of what she was hearing beyond the winds of falling, Carol wanted to prove John's theory true. If only she could move something, anything, let Dwight know she still lived.
"She hadn't told me yet,"
Farah said, and now Carol was close to certain that the girl and Dwight stood on opposite sides of the bed Carol must lie upon. Their voices came to Carol in such a way as to give the bedroom dimensions, and the blankets and pillows muted the harsher echoes that thundered through Howltown. Falling, falling, falling.
"But how much did she say?"
It was the way Dwight said this more than the words he chose. The way he sounded frightened that Farah might know more than he wanted her to know. If she could have moved, Carol would have shaken her head, no. If she could have spoken, she would have cried, "Tell her, Dwight, tell her I'm alive." But there was no parting of her lips, no cry for help.
She said,
"Out with it."
Carol felt as if she were falling through a cold patch, an area within the coma she had never been. Fear was no stranger to Howltown, no traveler from the trail, but the fear she felt now was shattering.
"She said she was feeling odd, Mr. Evers."
Farah blurted out. The horror in her voice, amplified in the coma, was deafening.
"She said something about a ripple coming. She
called it that?"
"Called what that?"
"A ripple, girl. She used that word?"
Carol tried hard to hear through the winds of the coma, through the papers Hattie used to crinkle by her ears.
"She used that word, yes. She told me she wanted to talk to me, Mr. Evers. Is she really dead?"
The hoarse breathing inhaled.
"Yes, she's dead."
Exhaled. Then the wind grew louder, as if Carol were falling faster. "It's very important that you tell me all you know, Farah." Dwight's voice was deeper and quieter than it was moments ago, Carol could imagine the expression he wore as he adopted this tone. It was the face Dwight made when he believed he could squeeze information out of someone he thought was less intelligent than himself. But Farrah didn't respond. Silence from the bedroom. Carol listened close.
"Farrah?"
Dwight said. A thud, something heavy falling to the floor. Then, as it sometimes mercifully occurred within the coma, the next words that were spoken told Carol exactly what had happened in the world she'd fallen from.
"She's fainted,"
Dwight said aloud, disbelieving.
"The maid has fainted."
Dwight's breathing came loud, near, and Carol wondered if perhaps he was going to cry. But the steadiness of his exhalations told Carol that he was exerting energy instead. He was carrying her again. Every few steps she heard the clack of his dress shoes against solid ground. The first floor again. In the kitchen, the echo was unmistakable. Dwight grunted, and Carol heard a door opening, and she tried to deny what she was hearing, what she knew to be true. Dwight was carrying her to the cellar. She could smell it now, too, the stuffiness that entombed her halfway down the stairs, the bitter stench of stored root vegetables, the dust of a cellar used primarily for stowing, with suitcases from past travels upon the trail, dresses that had lost some of their appeal, and suits Dwight no longer fit into. Help. There was an urgency to the sudden word, but Carol could not speak it. "He's hiding me," Carol thought, recalling their argument earlier this day. Could it be he was overreacting to her plea for further safety?
"I don't think he's hiding you for your sake, Angel,"
John's voice in Howltown.
"I think he's doing it for his own."
The sound of Dwight's steps changed. He'd crossed from the solid concrete of the cellar to the gravelly floor of the storeroom. There, Carol knew, stood the morgue-like slab she'd had installed herself if ever she and Dwight had to dine below as a tornado tore through the trail. Dwight's breathing changed pace. No longer the grunts of hard work, now the long exhalations of having completed a task. Carol knew she was on the slab, and yet, still falling. The hoarse breathing continued.
"Do not wake, dear,"
Dwight said, and his voice was without reason.
"You have no idea how dark it is, living in someone else's shadow."
Carol tried to understand, tried to process, but the singular idea that would not go away was simply too abhorrent to accept. "He wants you to stay this way."
"And for a man to go unseen in the shadow of his wife. Oh, Carol, do not wake. Do not deny me this triumph."
Falling, falling, falling. Then Carol heard his shoes leaving the storeroom, the creaking of the stairs leading up to the kitchen, footfalls in the hallway, then foyer. The front door opened, then closed. The hooves of the horses came to fiery life in the drive.
"Dwight!"
The sound of the carriage evaporated into a night Carol could only imagine.
"He wants you to stay this way."
But before Carol could ask another question, before she could attempt to make sense of the horrors upon her, the cellar door swung open again. Through the wind, Carol heard. Footsteps again on the creaking stairs. Had she gotten it wrong? Was Dwight still here? Bare feet on the stone floor, and the quick shuffling of someone approaching. A thief, perhaps. One of the many terrible men who stalked the trail. Someone had been watching the house, waiting for the coach to leave. As the bare feet reached the storeroom, then entered, the many rough faces she'd seen on the trail became one. It was a mask she'd known 20 years past, features not yet molded by life as an outlaw, and a name not yet legendary to those who heard it. James Moxie. For the duration of one slowed beating of her heart, she imagined Moxie entering the storeroom and removing her, undoing what Dwight had begun.
"Dwight wants you this way."
But could this be true?
"Carol!"
The shrieking sound of Farrah's voice so close to her ear echoed like a golden eagle's cracked call in Howltown.
"Carol! You look... you look..."
Farrah began sobbing again, heavy rain in the coma. And to the beat of Farrah's falling tears, Carol tried hard to defy the only explanation she could find, the answer to where Dwight must have gone. Dwight said she was dead. Dwight drove off in the carriage.
Don't think it. Please don't think it.
But it was too late to stop it from coming, and when it arrived, it was whole.
He drove to the funeral home. Help!
But nobody could hear a silent plea sung from the storeroom of the cellar in Harrow's, not even the girl who lamented beside her.
It's my worst fear,
Hattie once told a 9-year-old Carol as Mom hammered at wooden boards in the workroom.
My daughter buried alive.
But Carol was not buried. She was falling. 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 And the voices that accompanied her were the voices of memory, with no volume to tell a funeral home director she was alive, no hand to stop the gravediggers from shoveling, no fingers to lift the lid of a casket that might be coming soon. Closing soon, too.
Stop it!
Carol scolded herself.
You're afraid, that's all. You heard him wrong.
But she'd never misheard anything in Howelltown. The opposite, in fact. For as long as Carol could remember, the things she'd heard as she fell were beyond even the truth of the words themselves. There was the truth of the person behind them. What had Dwight begun?
Oh, Carol!
Farrah suddenly cried, and her voice was a banshee shriek.
You look alive!
Funeral arrangements at midnight. Dwight steered the gray steeds through downtown Harrow's, passing Sheriff Opal's station halfway to the southern border. Nobody was out. The death of Carol's homosexual friend John Bowie had sent a shiver through the town that Dwight could still feel clinging to the cool early evening air. It bothered him. Bowie was never a threat, not exactly. Because Bowie wasn't interested in women, Dwight felt just fine with all the time he and his wife had spent out on the porch, in the parlor, taking walks, talking. There was no stopping the inevitable suggestion Carol made that they inform John Bowie of Carol's condition, and there was nothing Dwight could think of to refute it. It was a very delicate business, planning a murder, and one had to be very careful with what one showed and what one didn't. Bowie's death was also inevitable, Dwight thought. Of course, there was no predicting whom the illness would suddenly take, and yet the way Bowie lived, the drinking and cavorting, the endless flirting and conversing, the idea that his mind and worldview might bring him to transcend the rituals most people had to endure, that was the end of John Bowie, and Dwight had spotted it the day he met him. Perhaps John was a threat after all. A philosophical threat. A spiritual adversary. Someone more fun than Dwight. But Dwight refused to admit it.
To Lafayette's!
Dwight called, snapping the reins, guiding the gray horses past downtown Harrow's to the wide-open wheat fields that always looked like ice drifts under the darkening sky. Lafayette lived here, in the border of dark willows that signified the start of the trail. Dwight thought and rehearsed. Rehearsed and thought. He imagined himself standing before the funeral director, Robert Manders.
Manders, he said, his voice trembling. She's gone.
But as the words fell false from his lips, his mind remained focused on the incredible series of events that had led him to where he was. The illness had taken Bowie in pieces. It always did. That's how it worked. And there had been plenty of time for Dwight to account for the fact that, with Bowie's eventual expiration, there would be nobody living who knew of Carol's condition. But for Carol to go under on the very same night Bowie was buried? Well, Dwight knew that was not exactly fortuitous luck. Carol was far too stubborn to recognize a correlation between her comas and the stresses life may or may not have placed upon her. Dwight had been keeping track of such things for close to 5 years. He'd even pointed it out to her, but Carol refuted this claim, insisting that if Hattie hadn't spotted it, it simply didn't exist. And yet it did exist. Carol went under the very night Hattie died, too. Emotional duress almost always sent Carol to Howelltown, Carol's childish name for the comas. He was about a mile away from Lafayette's shack. the pear-shaped, ponytailed, wrinkled witch of a trail watcher, whose primary source of income was connecting civil men with uncivil monsters. Carol had never liked her. Dwight wasn't sure he liked her himself. But there was a lot of Carol's money to go around now, and Lafayette knew better than most what to do with the surplus.
"Manders," Dwight said, changing the timbre of his voice slightly, a tad less sad. "She's gone."
John Bowie wasn't the only one who knew of Carol's condition, but Carol certainly didn't need to know about Lafayette. Dwight wanted to laugh with excitement, but couldn't. There were things to take care of before celebrating in any way. A quick conversation with Lafayette for starters, funeral arrangements with Manders straight after. And what of the girl Farah? How much did she know? Dwight had carried her to the guest bedroom and placed her gently upon the mattress. Best to look gentlemanly at this stage of the game. And if she woke while he was away, she wouldn't think to check the cellar. She'd simply discover that her lady was no longer in the master bedroom, and she'd rush into town, hysterical, claiming that her lady had died. All good for Dwight.
"Manders, she's gone."
But now Dwight wasn't using a sad tone at all. Now he was blubbering with enthusiasm as the lone light in Lafayette's shack came aflame like a lightning bug. A solitary life living in the shadows. "She really does live like a witch," Dwight thought. He parked the coach 20 feet from the lean-to and got down from the box quickly. Lafayette's door was open, as if this were only a summer night that had nothing to do with death, nothing to do with murder at all.
"Evers!"
Lafayette's wrinkled face was in the window. Dwight hadn't seen it until he was inches from the open door.
"She's under."
Lafayette didn't look surprised. She didn't look like she'd heard Dwight at all. Dwight imagined that it was one of the many reasons the trail watcher was good at what she did.
"Come inside."
Dwight crossed the shack's threshold and thought of Carol collapsing upon the threshold of the back door at home. By the time he reached the small wooden table within, Lafayette was already seated.
"So we begin," Lafayette said.
"Manders," Dwight said, nodding. "Tonight."
Lafayette held up a fat, open palm. Her eyes shone by candlelight.
"Too rushed. Do it tomorrow."
"I want her buried now."
Lafayette laughed, and with the laughter, Dwight felt as if he were seeing the woman for the first time, how she truly was. It felt something like discovering the edicts of a club after the initiation had taken place.
"He's not gonna bury her tonight, Dwight. You can count on that. Let's stick to the plan."
"Plan? Carol has gone under. We bury her. That's the plan."
Lafayette looked over her shoulder, through the open front door.
"Is she in the carriage?"
There was an uneasy, lustful curiosity in her voice. It made Dwight's stomach turn.
"She's at home, where she belongs, if Sheriff Opal were to ask."
Lafayette turned her emotionless eyes on Dwight.
"So while you're with Manders, she could wake and walk on out. Maybe go to Manders, too. Make a fool of you?"
"No, she won't wake tonight. She's never woken that quick."
"What's the quickest?"
2 days since we've been married, since she'd been under my watch.
"And before then?"
2 days!
Dwight bellowed. Even then, Lafayette showed no impatience, no anger.
"Then why rush?"
Dwight opened his mouth to speak, closed it, opened it again.
"I want her buried now."
Lafayette rested her heavy hands upon her considerable gut. In the lantern shadows, her ponytail looked something like a whip.
"It'll look like grief to Manders," Dwight said.
"Which it is, of course."
"Right, which it is."
Lafayette seemed to consider this.
"Anybody know she's died?"
"Yes."
Lafayette tilted her head.
"Who?"
"Farah Darrow, our maid." Carol collapsed at her feet.
"Kill her,"
Lafayette said without hesitation.
"No."
"Why not?"
"I want no signs of foul play."
"You're right,"
Lafayette said.
Then she belched.
If you killed her, it would only raise suspicion. I still say you smother Carol.
I won't do it.
I could.
Dwight felt a wave of rage, not because Lafayette had suggested killing his wife, but because Lafayette had emasculated him. And wasn't that exactly what Dwight was trying to bury?
It could work,
Lafayette suddenly said, dropping the current thread and picking up the former.
Going to Manders tonight could work, but you've got to play the celebrity angle.
Celebrity?
Your wife would have wanted a private ceremony. She's so adored, after all. And perhaps a clandestine burial would suit her wishes best. Make it about her, Dwight, not you.
Yes, about her.
Show me.
Many times Dwight had rehearsed for Lafayette, and yet with the moment at hand, the pressure of getting Carol underground was enormous. A clock ticked somewhere in Lafayette's shack. I'm going to go to Manders now, and... Lafayette raised her hand, the implication clear. So Dwight performed the lines he would deliver to Robert Manders. And as he did, Lafayette rose from the small table, her eyes bone white in the lantern light, as she modified Dwight's every word, coached him, even gripped him by the lapels of his jacket, slapped him, and roughed up his hair.
"There's a lot at stake here,"
Lafayette said.
"And I can't be there with you when you do it. You gotta look the part, Dwight. You gotta be it."
Dwight went through his lines again, his many moods.
"No,"
Lafayette said, and no again.
"Start over."
"Manders."
"No."
"Manders."
"No."
Their voices continued this way, echoes of themselves for hours. Dwight rehearsed as Lafayette paced the shack. Then, without a hint, Lafayette told Dwight she believed he was ready, and Dwight felt a flood of anxiety he'd never navigated before.
"It's time,"
Lafayette said, her voice like an unoiled tin joint.
"For Dwight Evers to face the world for the first time as a grief-stricken, crestfallen widower."
But as Dwight fled Lafayette's shack, as the moon above told Dwight he'd been inside for longer than he'd realized, longer than he'd wanted, the trail watcher called out one last time.
"Hell's heaven, Evers! Walk with less confidence! And cry!"
Harrow's one funeral parlor was a large, clean home overlooking the cemetery at the very northeastern border of town. Because the home was situated at the peak of a rather large hill, winter funerals were delicate, and more than one ceremony had included the creaking of coach wheels sliding. But come summer, the trees, the grass of the grounds, and even the graveyard itself spoke of a more well-tended garden than a place of final rest. Dwight had long considered the home one of the finest in Harrow's, and discussed with more than one local the shame of it being used for dressing bodies, burials, and meaningless final rites. Such potential, such austerity. And yet there was a gloom about the place. Despite the freshly painted green shutters, the manicured grounds, and the clouds reflected in the many clean windows, all Harrowsers had always known the home as the House of Death, it being the only place in Harrows to be buried, a place each of them would one day be laid to rest. Perhaps it was the wooden arch, the gateway to the graveyard, that gloomed it. The sky was dark when Dwight rode up the hill to the front steps. The white lilies framing the front walk shone. The girl Farah may have heard something of his and Carol's conversation earlier. Dwight couldn't know, but he couldn't focus on that now. No, no. That would have to come next. He'd already endured Lafayette. It was time for Manders. How well rehearsed was he? It was one thing to perform by Carol's sleeping body. It was certainly another to do it for Lafayette, even on the night of Carol's collapse. But as Dwight passed Sheriff Opal's station for the second time in less than 3 hours, and as the funeral home rose in relief against the moonlit sky, Dwight felt terribly unprepared. The feeling did not go away as he left Harrow's main street and reached the spacious plots of the homes belonging to the richer men and women of the trail. For the first time in his life, despite the anxiety, Dwight felt like he belonged up here, thanks to Carol's death. The money, of course, was his.
and some for Lafayette, he thought. But Lafayette didn't need to know the true numbers. Dwight steered the gray horses and followed the circle dirt drive until he was flush with the walk in the front steps. In the moonlight, his black suit appeared blue, and the gray strands in his hair glowed. He looked up to the big dark house and noted that not a single lantern flickered within. There was work to be done, Dwight imagined, what with the illness that had come to Harrow's. But even the gravediggers, even the mortician, needed to sleep. Then he looked beyond the house, down the hill, and could see well the wooden arch and, beyond it, the stone and wood markers jutting up from the earth. Black shadows cut the moonlight, and lanterns flickered in the summer breeze on posts placed far apart at the wooded borders of the grounds. John Bowie's grave still looked fresh, even in the scant light, and the lumpy earth kept the knowledge in Bowie's brain silent. Dwight knew there was no watchman, and yet ghouls were not uncommon in Harrow's, or in any town on the trail. Digging for buried treasure was easier than robbing banks. He also knew Robert Manders would be here. Aside from Sheriff Opal, nobody in Harrow's was as married to his job as Manders. Once he climbed down the black steps of the coach box, his boots connected hard with the gravel drive. Dwight crunched small stones and passed through the lilies before climbing the stone stairs leading to the oak front door. Manders, Dwight knew, lived a floor above the office, and two floors above the stone cellar where Norm Guster dressed bodies as though painting portraits of rubber kings and queens. In his way, Norm was Harrow's artist-in-residence, and not a funeral passed in which his work was not remarked upon. There was a break in the sky, a flash, followed by the sound of far-off thunder, as Dwight took hold of the brass knocker and sent a different kind of thunder through the funeral home. Rain came quiet. The girl, Farah, what did she hear? What does she know? But it wasn't time for that. Not yet. An immediate shuffling came from within, followed by a flickering light. Dwight saw movement from behind the windows framing the door. Again, Dwight thought of the waste, the shame of such a brilliant edifice being used for such parochial, specific needs. Then the great door opened, and Manders pulled his glasses from his sleep shirt pocket.
"Mr. Evers?"
Robert Manders was a small man, his thin hair always flattened to the contours of his head. His round cheeks rendered him eternally childish, despite his mature profession.
"I'm sorry to bother you, Robert. I didn't see a light in the window, but I have terribly sad news and need your assistance."
He thought of Lafayette pacing the shack, saying,
"No, no, no, that's wrong,"
in her creaking voice. Manders looked beyond Dwight, to the drive, and saw it was raining upon the coach.
"What is it, Mr. Evers?"
Dwight breathed deep.
"Carol has died this evening."
How did it sound? True? Manders, still able to feel sympathy, despite a thousand meetings like this one, placed a soft hand on Dwight's damp shoulder.
"I'm so sorry. Please come inside."
The foyer was black beyond the range of the funeral home director's lantern. Dwight followed him across the wood-floored foyer to the office. Manders stepped across a large green rug and patted the back of a small chair before rounding the desk and taking his seat behind it. Rain anxiously fingertipped the windows.
"Was it the illness?"
Manders asked, his bespectacled eyes reflecting the one lantern in the room.
"No, Robert."
Manders studied the widower's face.
"Has somebody seen her?"
"Seen her, Robert?"
Again Lafayette saying no. Dwight felt a bump in the rhythm of the conversation.
"A doctor. It's very important to know what she died of before proceeding. Might have been the illness."
Dwight reached his hand into his vest pocket and removed a folded piece of paper.
"Here is the determination," he said.
He rose and handed Manders the note. The funeral director read it slowly and looked up.
"Who wrote this? He's gonna ask who wrote it,"
Lafayette had said many weeks ago.
"A very close friend of mine, a man I went to school with."
"You went to medical school?"
"No, but we shared some studies. His name is Alexander Wolfe, a magnificent practitioner from Charles. Is something wrong with it?" Manders glanced at the paper again.
Not wrong, no, but contradictory. It says the cause of death is unknown. Is that right as you know it?
Dwight nodded. The word contradictory rattled in his mind.
But it also says she suffered